girlfriend is fairly serious.
This morning's meeting of the Ag Committee will now be in session. And Representative Kath, have you had a chance to peruse the minutes and give us approval?
Extensively, Mr. Chair.
I take that as a yes. Thank you.
And I would make a motion that we adopt the minutes.
We have a busy agenda again this morning, and would ask that if you have a burning question, you can bring it up as the presentation is going along. Otherwise, save your questions until the end when we finish all of the presenters. That way, maybe we can get all of them in and have all of their information given to us. So, a burning question, bring it up. If not, hold it until we're through. We'll call up Quinn Cheney from the Department of Agriculture, the Legislative Director, and say good morning. And also Dr. Heidi Kassenborg, the Division Manager, Director of Dairy and Foods Division.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Quinn Cheney, the Policy Director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I talked to you last week about the Department of Agriculture's non-regulatory divisions, those that were focused specifically on promotion. So today I'm going to talk to you about the regulatory component of the agency. There are four divisions that are involved in regulatory activities: dairy and food inspection, plant protection, pesticide and fertilizer management, and our laboratory services. The mission at the Department of Agriculture, I think I talked to you about last week. I just want to highlight that today the portion of our mission that we're really going to focus on is that's really related to ensuring the integrity of our food supply and the health of our environment. And now Dr. Heidi Kassenborg is the director of our Dairy and Food Division, and she's going to talk to you about their responsibilities.
Go ahead, Doctor.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is the structure of our division. We have a broad statutory responsibility from feed all the way up to grocery stores. And programmatically, we've divided it up into food inspection, dairy, meat, egg, and poultry, and then also feed inspection. Often a question comes up, well, how do you differ from health, the health department, and those sorts of inspections? So this is a bit of a schematic that describes kind of those different roles. And also from the Board of Animal Health's point of view, because our statutory requirements sometimes overlap. And at the farm level, of course, the Board of Animal Health has jurisdiction primarily over live animal diseases. Then when we come in is at the dairy farm. We have statutory responsibility for dairy farms, dairy processing, food processing, meat processing, and then also retail establishments. And what we mean by retail establishments are grocery stores or convenience stores, those types of activities. Where the dividing line is really, you can think of it as the plate, when the food gets to the plate. When it gets to the home or restaurant, that's where the Department of Health and their environmental health services comes in to do their regulatory role. They've delegated some of that to local health boards. And then they monitor surveillance. They do surveillance for foodborne diseases. And then once they figure out that it's a food product, then we do the trace back and we help them with that. So that kind of comes full circle. So why is inspection important? What does it mean for the consumer? What does it mean for the taxpayer? Well, often, especially on the small to medium-sized firms, our inspector is really the firm's only exposure to food safety in a large amount of cases. And so our role, of course, is to enforce the statutes, but really we start with inspection and education, because we really want to improve the system of food safety. We don't no longer just look at what we used to call floors, walls, and ceilings. We look at the system of food safety so that the firm has the controls in place so to be able to produce a safe product, and then if something does occur, to take corrective action. And so when we're not there. And what this boils down to is that if there is a foodborne illness, it doesn't just affect the people that become ill. It also affects those that produce that product. And not only if it's a particular firm, such as when there was a peanut butter outbreak, all peanut butter manufacturers suffered from that. So it's not just the actual firm, but it can also affect a whole commodity group. So when breaking down what the individual inspection programs do, our feed inspection activity, some people are surprised that feed is in there, but when you think about it, the feed that goes into animals will someday become food for humans. And so they do a variety of tasks, from looking at prohibited mammalian protein, making sure that no parts of the animals that could carry these types of diseases don't come into the feed supply, looking at feed manufacturers, but then a lot of their time is done looking at medicated feed manufacturers, making sure that they are doing the right quantities and the right controls so that we don't run up into antibiotic residues. If there are antibiotic residue issues, we also do the tracebacks. And then we have a little bit of the sort of final step in the whole process is the rendering facilities. Our dairy program, we've got over 4,000 what we call grade A farms in Minnesota. Those are the farms that produce milk for the fluid milk, so the milk you drink from the grocery store. And then we have 415 what we call manufacturing. Those are mostly cheese plants or dried milk. Those that basically that's not fluid milk. We also look at the plant inspections, or we also look at plants and inspect those. And so we do almost 150 grade A and greater than 90 manufacturing grades. And what we do in those facilities, one of the big tasks is to test out the pasteurizers and to make sure that they're working properly. They can be a fairly complex piece of machinery, and that's really the step that ensures the safety of the milk when it leaves the door. We are also what's considered an equal to state. What that means, we are equal to USDA's Food Safety Inspection Service, so that we are allowed to, so that processors that are inspected by us can sell their product within the state of Minnesota. Most of the meat in the United States, is the ones that you get at the grocery store, probably came from a USDA facility, because only USDA facilities, inspected facilities, can sell meat across borders, state borders. But if you're an equal to state, those facilities can produce product that can be sold within the state's borders. We have 62 facilities and provide 2,000 days of slaughter inspection, and then over 10,000 processing inspections. These types of facilities differ from what's called custom exempt, and this is probably what you may have experienced with locker plants. This is meat that is marked not for sale, and so if you bring an animal in, have it slaughtered for your own purposes, then that particular product, we don't inspect the process of that. We just inspect those facilities for sanitation and cleanliness, and that's only done on a quarterly basis. That meat cannot be sold to others, but it can be obviously fed to people's family and their non-paying guests. And then food inspection. We do the majority of food facility inspections in Minnesota. We do, and actually when you look at across the nation, most state inspection programs do most of the food facility inspections, not FDA. We actually receive some funding to do contract inspections for FDA. So probably the majority, over 90%, are done by state inspection programs. We've got 4,400 retail facilities, grocery stores, but then we also have over 1,300 food manufacturers and processors of various sizes. And then last is our role in outbreak and product contamination issues. We've been involved in several high-profile investigations, you know, anywhere from E. coli 157 H7 outbreaks at a Taco Bell, salmonella in what ultimately came up to be a jalapeno pepper, but was first tied to tomatoes. And then probably one of our most recent ones is the salmonella and peanut butter, as far as the higher profile ones. And our agency, especially our laboratory, was instrumental in finding that particular pathogen in the salmonella in the peanut butter. So this is also where we partner with the state health agency with their foodborne disease investigators. Here's our budget. We get about $10.5 million from biennial budget for the general fund. We also have some in the agriculture, what we call dedicated funds. We have some federal funding. Some of that federal funding will probably be going away, about $500,000. One of our grants that will be ending here in the summertime. And we have 111 FTEs. And those, majority of those live in Greater Minnesota because they work out of their home offices and inspect the facilities around their home. So they actually have to live in the area that they inspect. So probably greater than three quarters live in Greater Minnesota.
And Mr. Chair, I'll just point
Cheney?
Out that I made a small typo in this presentation, and the number under the total biennial base budget is just the general fund dollars, and I didn't add it all up yet, so I can get you an accurate slide at the end. But if you just add up those numbers, you'll have the right number.
Dr. Kassenborg, is it your division that is in charge of or investigating the recent raw milk episodes in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Could you give us a brief update on that?
Mr. Chair, I will give an update as much as I can legally do because this particular investigation, it's still under investigation, and so we are limited to what we can say about it. The most current filing is an order of contempt for Mr. Hartman. That was filed recently because when we went out to destroy the product that was under embargo, a lot of it we claim is missing. So when we went out there in June to inspect the facility, there was a lot of product that was adulterated, and this particular group of products, Mr. Hartman contested that finding. The judge found in late December that our claim that the product was adulterated he supported our claim, overwhelmingly supported our claim that the state did have the authority to destroy this product that was under embargo. And then the judge gave us 30 days to destroy that product. When we went out there in early January, a lot of the product was missing, and so that's the reason for the filing for contempt.
Ms. Cheney.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yeah, Representative Morrill.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little uncomfortable with this direction. I mean, I'm fine with a quick report, but first, this person is my constituent. This person isn't been told we're going to start discussing this matter. We've been told this matter is in litigation. I think the scope of the question really has to be narrower. Perhaps we should just move on in the presentation.
Advice well taken. Ms. Cheney?
I just wanted to add, Mr. Chair, that I do have a fact sheet that describes things that are appropriate to say that aren't part of the actual investigation, therefore protected data. And I can bring that later this week to distribute to members.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks, Doctor. Now coming up, Geir Friesel from the Division Director of Plant Protection.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Geir Friesel, the Director of Plant Protection Division, and our division is composed basically of six broad units of fruit and vegetable and grain, seed and noxious weeds, nursery inspection and export certification, pest detection and response, pest suppression and biocontrol, and potato inspection. The first one, the fruit and vegetable and grain unit, we do things like grain licensing. And what grain licensing does is provides a system of bonding in order to protect farmers when they store their grain at these storage areas. We also provide bonding for wholesale dealers licenses. And again, this is a way to protect growers and producers who have products that they have sold or delivered or contracted. Another area in this unit is our fruit and vegetable inspection, and these are inspections that we provide under a USDA agreement. And basically what we're doing is certifying the grades of a particular commodity. So if a wholesaler is buying a large quantity of fruit and vegetables, they would hire us to grade that, and that's how some of the prices are set for that transaction. We also provide food safety audits. Some number of businesses, such as Chipotle's and Subway, require that the food that they want, the food safety having been done on those farms, and we provide that service. Our seed and noxious weed unit, we ensure that the seed labels are accurate, that they're correct, and that they're consistent, and all the information that is required is provided to farmers and growers. We do collect samples of the seed. We verify that the seed germination is within certain parameters. We verify the purity of the seed and also the genetic identity of the seed. And then finally, we assist counties with the implementation of the noxious weed law. Our nursery inspection and export certification program, we inspect about 2,500 nursery dealers and growers. This unit also issues export certificates, and these are for shipments going to over 70 countries. China is by far the biggest buyer of Minnesota products. In fact, just over last year, there's been almost a five-fold increase in exports from Minnesota to China. We inspect and certify migratory apiaries. There are a number of apiaries that take their bees to California to pollinate almond groves, and they are required to have an inspection to verify that they're not diseased. And then finally, we administer a wolf and elk compensation program. This is a program that basically provides compensation to ranchers and farmers if they suffer loss from either a wolf depredation or from elk getting into their crops. Our pest detection response unit, this is the unit that really kind of deals with any up-and-coming or recent plant pest threats that are on the horizon. This is really where the sort of the regulatory arm of the division is focused. And we've dealt with things such as potato cyst nematode, carnal bunt. We sample for carnal bunt every year in wheat. We've never found it, and that's good because that allows us to ship Minnesota wheat to the EU and to Asia. We look for soybean cyst nematode. Again, this is a pest of quarantine concern, and we are able to verify which counties are free of this pest, and again, that allows farmers in those counties to ship unhindered. We are in charge or the lead of the Emerald Ash Borer Program, and I know that sometimes surprises people that the Department of Agriculture is responsible for forest pests, but that's because at both the federal and the state level, most of the regulatory programs for exclusion and quarantine are with the Departments of Agriculture. Then once it transitions to a management, then it's Forest Service and DNR. And finally, I wanted to mention Ralstonia blight. This one's a kind of a fun one because we got to burn a bunch of plants. And this is in 2004, there were about 27 nurseries that received geranium seedlings from Kenya, Africa. And we found that those seedlings had a bacteria called Ralstonia. Ralstonia is a blight that does not exist in North America, and it may not be a big deal for geraniums, but it's a serious, serious potato disease. So it was extremely important that we eradicated this disease. So, as I said, we went to the 27 nurseries, and we were able to have these nice bonfires in the middle of winter, and we destroyed those infected plants. Just wanted to mention a little about potato cyst nematode. We've done a great deal of work. This is a serious pest that was found in Idaho a few years ago. It was first found in New York in 1941 and was contained there up until just a few years ago when it was found in Idaho. And so We have taken over 10,000 soil samples, and we've covered over 56,000 acres of potato fields. And that's just shows the number of samples collected and surveyed. And one of the reasons this is we were very concerned about potato cyst nematodes, because many of our potato producers buy seed from Canada, and it was recently discovered that Alberta, Canada, had also had potato cyst nematodes. So we were very concerned that Minnesota growers might have introduced inadvertently potato cyst nematode, but fortunately we have not found this pest in Minnesota.
Excuse me, Mr. Friesel, we have a question from Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, I was just, and this goes back to the Emerald Ash Borer again, I just wanted a little clarification on the jurisdiction between, you know, the DNR and the Department of Agriculture. So are you saying that there are invasives that have dual jurisdiction here, that the Ag Department has jurisdiction over the quarantine and trying to stop the spread, but as far as forest management, you're saying that there the DNR has jurisdiction? So is there a period of time where there's jurisdiction between both departments? There's not a clean transfer of jurisdiction from one to the other, in other words. Is that correct?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct, and we do work very closely with the DNR, so I certainly don't want to say that we're working in a vacuum, but again, at both the state and the federal level, it's the quarantine authorities and the regulatory authorities are structured so that any new plant pest coming into the state falls to the Department of Agriculture's responsibility, and that's where we get our funding from USDA APHIS. Now, USDA Forest Service is funding DNR, and there is a transition, and in fact, in situations such as gypsy moth, there's a very definite demarcation as to when we will transition from going from eradication to suppression. And when it's suppression or management, then that's clearly a DNR. But we do work very, very closely together, and we have committees that work together, and it's very much a partnership. But the lead role right now is with agriculture, and then that'll flip with time. So.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question about the Ralstonia blight kind of situation, or when you talked about that was destroyed and they had received that. I'm just wondering if there's a compensation for the loss, or if there's and who is responsible for that. If you're destroying something that a company would want to sell.
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, unfortunately in this case there was no compensation for these nurseries. There has been for other situations, plum pox, for example, where Congress actually provided a compensation, or a citrus greening in Florida, the orchards were compensated. In this particular case, there was no funds available to compensate the growers, so they did take a loss. My guess is that there may have been some that the broker or the supplier maybe bore some of that cost, but I don't know. But we did not provide any compensation.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Friesel, just kind of to elaborate a little further on that Ralstonia blight, does the department check incoming vegetation? Or how did that stuff get here without somebody knowing that it was a problem before it arrived in our borders?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we learned about this. International shipments are, of course, administered by the federal government, by USDA APHIS, and they're the ones that first picked up. They had done a random testing of those plants coming in, and then also the state of Wisconsin, who had done random testing, found it. So it was really a result of some trace forward work, and so we followed up and looking for it. We do some random testing. We have a very nice laboratory within the Department of Agriculture, so we do run samples for things like Ralstonia or sudden oak death and those sorts of things for it. But in this particular case, it was more a situation of trace forwards, where we knew there was a supplier that was shipping contaminated products.
Go ahead, Mr. Friesel.
Okay, this is not a picture of me when I started in agriculture, but I came across this and I thought it was interesting, because this is a photograph showing barberry eradication, plant protection statutes are some of the oldest statutes on the books in Minnesota, and this was a joint project between USDA and the state. And what they were doing is removing barberry bushes, which is the alternate host for black stem rust in wheat. Black stem rust continues to be a very, very serious disease and threat to wheat in Minnesota. And as old as this picture is, we are still looking for black stem rust, because this is a rust, and they mutate, and so there's always new strains of this rust coming. So we monitor for the spores, barberry is a common nursery plant, so we take samples of barberry, and again, we utilize our laboratory for testing that. We have a potato inspection program. This is headquartered in East Grand Forks. Minnesota has about 8,500 acres of seed potatoes that are grown, and we certify that those seeds are free of various viruses or other plant pests or pathogens. We provide about 2,000 shipping point inspections, and a shipping point inspection is where somebody's shipping potatoes and they want them graded so that to prove that they meet certain parameters for the buyer. And then we also conduct about 8 to 9 million hundredweight of fall processing inspections, and this is when a farmer sells his potatoes to be processed. Part of his payment is based on the grade of those potatoes, and that's what the service that we are providing for the inspection. We also do more long-term pest suppression, and this is also in our biological control program. This is our gypsy moth program. We set about 20,000 traps every year. Last year we treated about 98,000 acres with pheromone flakes. And the majority of this funding comes from both the U.S. Forest Service and USDA APHIS. And this is a good example of one that will transition over to the DNR as this pest becomes established in the state. Our biological control program, we've been very active in Emerald Ash Borer is a pest that we probably will not be able to win the battle over, but we have been very active in trying to introduce some biological control agents. We released about 2,000 agents in Houston County last summer, and then we intend to release some more, what they're called, a small stingless wasp in the Minneapolis. And I do have, I don't know if the members are interested, I have some souvenir emerald ash borers, if anybody would want one, that pass along. We also have introduced a fungus to try and attack gypsy moth, and we've been working with a number of weed targets, leafy spurge, spotted knapweed, and tansy. And then finally, our budget, the total is about $14.4 million. General fund is about $4.26 million. Ag funds is $7 million, and then federal grants is about $3 million. And the federal grants varies quite a bit, and recently it really goes up and down depending on what the pest happens to be. And in the case of emerald ash borer, we got close to $1 million just for that one alone. So.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add something for this slide. I also put the outdoor heritage bullet on there in the legend just so that I made sure that we referenced it. We did get some funding for invasive pest control in a couple years ago, specifically for emerald ash borer, and to do some studies on how cities and townships are prepared for any sort of invasive pest. So that was one-time money, but I did want to just highlight that that was something that we had for the last biennium, but it's at zero now for the forecast base.
Thanks, Ms. Cheney. A question from Representative Fall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have two questions, if you would allow me. I guess the first one is for Mr. Friso, which is on the most recent topic, but the talking about introducing different types of species or fungi to help control some of these pests, I think maybe the public would like to know a little bit about what that process is. I think maybe the Eurasian beetle was one of the ones that was thought to have been a good control for aphids, but maybe didn't work as well and has really kind of been maybe a blight on this type of action. So what type of approval process is there, and what type of maybe checks are in place to make sure that some of these miscalculations or missteps can be avoided in the future.
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a very good point, and you're exactly right. There are some hugely embarrassing catastrophes from introductions in the past, and Asian ladybug is certainly one of them. And because of that, there's much, much, much more strict requirements before a biological control agent can be brought in, and typically it'll take 5 to 10 years of testing. And in the case of these stingless wasps, they are very specific to the genus Agrylis. There are some native Agrylis in Minnesota that would be susceptible to this, but those other Agrylis are also considered pests, bronze birch borer being one of them. And so there was, I suppose there's certain risk-benefit trade-offs that had to be made as to whether or not it was the loss of a potential impact on other Agrylis species, but there's no impact on human health or other environments. So it was felt that given the devastation that's posed by emerald ash borer, that was worth introducing that. And in the case of gypsy moth, the fungi that's being introduced is actually a native fungi. It's just that it's manufactured and distributed over a wider area.
And Representative Falk?
Thank you for that. And I think maybe as we continue to go forward, if the department could provide us with a little bit more information just to help us get our hands and minds around it. The second thing I wanted to ask about is when dealing with plant protection and kind of the classifications of seed and our seed labeling laws, we oftentimes see a certain brand identification, but we don't always see the varietal information. We don't see the necessarily the breeder traits or where that is coming from. I think Canada's got much stronger disclosure laws about what type of seed it is, because you may be purchasing XYZ soybean from one particular brand and it's the same exact characteristics as so it's sold by another company. And we, as my understanding, there's maybe 4 or 5 major soybean breeders that are left in existence in the United States, but we really don't know what the varietal traits are of each of these genetics, and probably similar in corn. I can't speak as fluently about that, but I just understand the soybean side of it a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about what the department can do or is doing to help at least farmers have the best information about what particular genetics they are planting?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a good question. It's also been a topic of a discussion over many years, and of course it involves some of the proprietary protections that the companies feel that they need to maintain, whereas we and the statutes do recognize that farmers need to be knowledgeable about what seed they're purchasing. Right now, the law does allow using brand as a way of identifying what this particular seed is.
Representative Fall.
Thank you. So just for a follow-up clarification, when you use the brand identification, that basically is an ability or a way for the seed companies to keep the genetic traits or those lines so they're not identified. Is that's kind of what my question is?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they still have to provide the variety, but the actual genetics may not have to be provided. So you can have two companies that have the exact same genetics in a crop, but they may name it two different varieties and have two different brands. So from that standpoint, it may appear to be different, but the genetics are the same, but the variety must be stated or provided.
Thank you. Mr. Friesel? Oh, I'm sorry. One more question, Mr. Friesel, for the Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Friesel, if I can take you back to the emerald ash borer, and thank you for the little samples. A couple of questions. How long does this adult emerald ash borer survive in the open?
Mr.
What's
Friesel.
What's his life cycle?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's an annual, so it the larvae overwinter So it's spending the winter in the larval stage, and then it will pupate and then come out as a beetle in the spring, and then they'll feed on the leaves and then mate, and they'll start laying their eggs again in the fall. So it's just a one-year cycle.
All right. The reason I asked...
Romansky?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've heard of some landowners finding some grubs in their ash trees when they're cutting firewood, and they say they're infested with emerald ash borer and we're going to get rid of them all. Could you do little samples with some larvae stage emerald ash borers as well and make that available so that someone cutting wood, you know, can identify if it is or isn't emerald ash borer when they're processing their firewood?
Mr. Friesel?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, that's exactly right. And there are a wide number of wood-boring insects, and we do have on our website, we put together quite a bit of material to help landowners or to understand what they're looking at and to help whittle it down a little bit, that we'd be happy to. The emerald ash borer larvae, surprisingly, as small as that beetle is, the larvae is actually about 3 to 4 times as big, so it's quite large. And they have very distinctive galleries, and the galleries are on this on our website as well. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Friesel. I believe next up is Greg Bezicki, Division Manager from Pesticides and Fertilizer. Good morning. State your name, Mr. Bezicki.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Greg Bezicki. I'm the director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. Very pleased to be here. What I'd like to do today is provide a broad overview of what our division does, who we are, a little bit about our programs. I'll try to answer any questions that you or the committee may have, and if I can't answer the questions, we'll promptly get back to you and provide the information. It's a complicated division, and I don't always have all the answers, so I'd be happy to provide it at a later time. Very simply, we regulate pesticides and fertilizers. Expanded relatively recently because of a certain amount of the clean water funding activity is flowing through our division, and I'll speak a little bit about that. But in regulating pesticides and fertilizers and some other inputs such as lime and soil amendments, we don't just deal with the regulation and the enforcement. Next slide I'll show also deals with some of our other responsibilities. So it's much larger than just dealing with regulation. First, what we try to do is, in dealing with the regulatory aspects of what we do, is try to inform and educate pesticide users, applicators, people who store and do commerce in pesticides, as to what their responsibilities are. We conduct a large number of inspections throughout the state. Some of these are use inspections on growers actually using products. Most of our attention, though, is focused on facilities. These are the places where pesticides are stored and commercial applicators operate out of. We respond to misuse investigations. These are complaints that we receive about pesticide misuse where there may be harm to individuals or the environment, and we'll do inspections, and sometimes these result in enforcement actions. Depending upon what we find and what the evidence shows. Also, one of the things that we've been doing for a long time, and talk a little bit more about this later when we get to some of the programs, is we respond to emergencies and long-term contamination. We have spill response, and we have Superfund authority. Again, I'll speak a little bit about that later as well. Finally, we conduct enforcement actions. These are legal actions. We like to start out with relatively low levels, such as warnings, but it does on occasion result in monetary penalties. Well, that's a real quick overview of the regulatory responsibilities, but very importantly, we deal with non-regulatory issues with pesticides and fertilizers as well. One of the things we spend a great deal of resources on and time is the monitoring of pesticides in ground and surface water. We actually began monitoring groundwater for pesticides in 1985. We have one of the most comprehensive and longest-running programs in the country, and we began monitoring surface water in 1991. Again, that is probably one of the longest monitoring surface water monitoring programs in the country for pesticides. We promote best management practices. We determine best management practices. We have statutory authority for doing so. We work with the university and with users and with organizations, farm groups, and applicators, and so forth, review the information and actually go through a formal process of developing best management practices, and we promote those with our applicators and farm groups, commodity organizations, and so forth. As I said, we administer clean water research funds, and frankly, one of the really exciting things that's taking place right now is the amount of research that's taking place in Minnesota relating to agricultural practices, water, and water quality protection. There's a tremendous amount of capability, capacity that's been developed through the clean water funds, and finding science-based solutions to some of our issues is vital to agriculture. We also manage, collect waste pesticides, spend quite a bit of money each year doing that. We budget about $600,000, and we've been doing that since 1991. We administer a program called AFRAC, which is the Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council. This was significantly developed or debated. I'm sure some of the members who've been here for a while are well aware of this, but this was debated for a number of years. It's actually a 40-cent per ton fertilizer fee that is dedicated to fertilizer research in Minnesota. Now, and while it focuses on production, it also deals with water quality issues as well. So this is growers funding a research entity to help them better use their fertilizer dollars, and it's coupled with the clean water work. It's a very exciting thing to see this amount of research underway in Minnesota. It holds it bodes well for the future. And finally, we have a policy program on that develops a pesticide management plan and a nitrogen fertilizer management plan. These are plans that are developed with growers and growers association, the university, and environmental groups to understand exactly what the status is for the protection of groundwater from pesticides and fertilizers, two separate entities, and to develop a process in which to address some of those issues. Our statutory authority is found principally in Minnesota Statutes 18 B, C, D, and E. 18 B is the Minnesota Pesticide Control Law. C is the Fertilizer and Soil Amendment Law. 18D is the our enforcement language, and 18E is our agricultural chemical response and reimbursement account. This is basically our cleanup fund. The industry and growers have been assessed a surcharge going back since the early 90s. And this surcharge goes into a dedicated account in which is used principally for, well, entirely for cleanup, but principally for reimbursement of contaminated sites or emergency spill response that takes place. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. That's the voluntary, if you will, program for cleaning up spills, but the gorilla in the closet is the Superfund law. Those of you who are familiar with Superfund or are attorneys know that it's joint and several liability. It's something that people really don't want to get involved in with state-overseen Superfund sites. So the great thing about agriculture is that for the last 20 years, we have been cleaning up our sins, quote-unquote, and spills of previous years, cleaning and getting that contamination out of the soil and protecting groundwater across the state. Finally, one of the key federal authorities that we operate under is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. This is commonly known as FIFRA. This is the federal counterpart to our pesticide control law, and we work with the federal government in administering FIFRA, and that is cited in our statutes as well. And as I mentioned, we also oversee the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment Funds. Who are we? Basically, we are scientists and regulators and technical people. We have a division that is comprised mostly of agronomists, soil scientists, hydrologists, and hydrogeologists. I myself am a soil scientist from way back when. We have about 80 staff members. Later I'll show a figure that shows an FT equivalent that's smaller than that. But we have a number of part-time folks or partial folks and interns and so forth. So we've got about 86 staff members on our payroll right now. About 30% of those staff are located in greater Minnesota. Those are largely our inspectors, and we have a number of hydrologists and people who do a lot of field work are located out there. However, a lot of our office staff travel. They travel. They don't. Their principal work location here is in St. Paul, but we do spend a lot of time in greater Minnesota. So some of those folks have the luxury of being able to put on boots a lot. I get the luxury of putting boots on only occasionally, but we do like to get out in greater Minnesota as much as we possibly can. And finally, for the committee, as Mr. Friso said, there's always surprises when you learn about our authorities. One of the things that I constantly have to remind people that we do work in rural and urban areas. We register about 12,000 pesticide products a year. And while the vast majority in terms of amount are used in agricultural production or silviculture, tree production, the vast majority of the number of products are actually used in non-agricultural settings. Those are sanitizers, disinfectants. Those are things that are used to clean hospitals, things that are used in pest prevention in food establishments like Ms. Kassenberg was talking about. There's a lot of pesticide products. In fact, it's rare that I walk into any kind of commercial store without seeing a number of our products, not only the products that we register for use in Minnesota on those shelves. So I just want to remind the committee, even though this is agriculture, we do an awful lot of work in urban areas and in the Twin Cities areas as well.
Excuse me, Mr. Bozicki, a question from Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bozicki, and maybe you touched on this beforehand, but one of those urban pesticide uses, I think, affects or could have the effect on our tourism and local economy, and that's in the hotel business or in some of our apartments and condos, and that's the issue of bed bugs. And I'd like to know what the department is doing relating to that emerging issue.
Mr. Bozicki.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, even though you worked for us for a number of years, I did not know that you had access to my final slide. The final statement actually has to do with bed bugs, and it's labeled as an emerging issue. bed bugs are actually a major issue in Minnesota right now. I don't know that it is widely discussed. I think we all see a bit of it in the papers and so forth. Perhaps a hotbed is in Ohio and some of the eastern states, where it is it has been a very, very significant and very public issue. It will become that way here in Minnesota. It is only a matter of time. So it is going to be here. What we're doing right now is we do have some staff that are working with various communities to get the word out on bed bugs. We are working with an advisory group. We have a staff member that's assigned. A significant proportion of his time is working on the issue, and we have just recently obtained a federal grant, or helped to obtain a federal grant to get more information, outreach information out on this issue and how to manage it. One of our big concerns, Mr. Chair, is misuse of pesticides. We have not responded to any misuse of pesticides in any significant fashion on bed bugs that I'm aware of, but our concern is going to be where people are using, for example, of highly toxic egg-type products in a household environment. So right now we're very much at the information and an awareness stage. We've been doing that for better part of a year, I would say, and be happy to provide more information in detail. We do have a active interagency university public-private advisory group that's working right now, and we do have a professor over at the university who's quite an authority on bed bugs. So we have some things going for us.
Any more questions?
Okay,
Mr. Bezicki, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a variety of regulatory activities that we carry out. This is a sampling of them, but I just thought I'd throw out a few facts to give some perspective. We register, as I said earlier, about 12,000 pesticide products, and we register about 3,500 fertilizer products. We license a large number of folks. About 6,000 commercial applicators, 3,200 non-commercial applicators. We certify about 17,000 growers in the state. That's where we work very closely with the University of Minnesota to provide testing, and we provide the certification. We also license 325 commercial animal waste technicians. These are the folks that apply manure for profit. And we have about 1,760 licensed fertilizer applicators. Each year we respond to about 60 to 70 emergencies, pesticide or fertilizer emergencies. We do have a 24/7 on-call team. These are folks that we work with the duty officer. We will get called if it's a pesticide or fertilizer issue, and we will be working not as the first line responders, but in support. Generally, the first line responders are fire departments in many cases. But if it's a pesticide issue and people are working in response to that, we will be providing the technical support to make sure that the environment and people are protected to the best of our ability as pesticide and fertilizer regulators. We also deal with a large number of cleanup sites. We have, for example, about 100 active sites that we're working on right now. These are long-term contamination. And we've closed, over the years, we've closed almost 600 long-term sites. When you think about it, back in the 50s and 60s, we used pesticides and fertilizers in a lot of our small towns, and frequently those businesses were operated near the city well, and right in the business district. I know of one small town that had three of them surrounding the square where the well was. These facilities led to contamination, spillage, incidental spillage, and so forth would take place. And these places need to be cleaned up. So the Groundwater Protection Act provided this ACRA fund that I mentioned earlier, so that acts like an insurance program, and so that the people who do the appropriate cleanup are reimbursed about 80%, up to $350,000. So over those last 20 years, we've cleaned up 600 of those sites. By the way, during that period of time, we responded to over 5,000 emergency sites as well. And we've got 9 Superfund states. You might be surprised to know that the department oversees Superfund for pesticides and fertilizers only. 4 of them are closed, and there's 5 active. So that's a little bit of our regulatory activities. As I mentioned earlier, we deal with the ground and surface water monitoring. We monitor in, we have a very sophisticated monitoring program for groundwater in which we divide up the state into 9 regions. We analyze water quality samples from groundwater in those regions. We conduct statistical analysis to determine trends. And the good news is that since we've been dealing with these issues, our only significant trend in terms of pesticide concentration is downward. And that is, we used to find a lot of atrazine up in the central sand plains, and over time, growers have actually used atrazine in such a way that the concentration has actually gone down. Having said that, we find atrazine in low concentrations a lot. We issue reports every year. All those reports are online. It's a lot of detail, but it's very transparent so that people can look at that information and review it. We also do surface water samples. Surface water is a whole different issue than groundwater. Things move to surface water, and we frequently find pesticides there, but the good news is that we find very few times very high concentrations of pesticides in surface water. One of the other, as I mentioned, we have a fertilizer and pesticide management plan. One of the other things we do is waste pesticide collection. Minnesota pesticide ewers, growers and urban folks, have helped us collect 4.6 million pounds of pesticides in the last 20 years. That's 4.6 million pounds that isn't available for spillage or for movement to ground and surface water. I did earlier talk about our ACRA account. We have provided reimbursement to the tune of about $30 million over the last 20 years. We budget about $2 million each year. That account actually has a significant amount of resources in it, and it resulted in a pesticide. This is a reserve, and we actually reduced our ACRA surcharge a couple of years ago, and we reduced it by two-thirds since we weren't using the dollars. A lot of that had to do with having staff resources to oversee the projects, and we're anticipating that that demand is going to increase. I did talk about the Ag Fertilizer Research and Education Council. I'm not sure if I mentioned that was $800,000 that is dedicated to research on production practices. Some of our other non-regulatory activities is we do a large number of surveys. One of the problems we have with agriculture is that folks don't understand agriculture all that well anymore. So what we're trying to do is make sure that we have very good, solid data as to what people are actually doing, as opposed to what people who aren't familiar with agriculture think they might be doing. It's getting that information that we can base decisions and you can make decisions. So we do pesticide use surveys with our Ag Stats division. We have fan map surveys, which the best way to describe it is we actually sit down at the in a very cooperative fashion. We sit down with growers. We ask permission to sit down at their kitchen table, and we go over their fertilizer or pesticide practices in detail so we really understand what a particular group of growers are doing. Been doing this for about 15 years, and it's an excellent program because now we actually understand what is taking place rather than making assumptions. We promote best management practices, clean water funding. We'll be going into that more, I'm sure, at another date, but we have a large number of technical support programs, projects that we're doing, research projects, and in addition to that, we've increased our ground and surface water capacity to look at pesticides at very low levels along the lines of what USGS has been doing for a number of years. Finally, as far as the emerging issues, one of the things that is going to be going public today is the NPDES permit. This is the National Pollutant Discharge and Elimination System. This is a program that has been provided, that has been generated because of a legal issue, a litigation that took place a number of years ago in which EPA was directed to develop an NPDES permit program for certain types of pesticide use. We have been working very closely with the Pollution Control Agency. They will be announcing exactly what their permit plan is today. While historically we have regulated pesticides through FIFRA, this is going to result in a major change in which some aspects of pesticide use will now be regulated through the Clean Water Act, which is administered by the Pollution Control Agency. Another emerging issue is one that I'm sure you've heard about. It's the University of Minnesota's framework. This has very significant impacts on agriculture and environmental issues associated with that, and I'm sure it's one that you and we will be engaged in talking about for some time. Groundwater protection. We have a very serious concern about nitrates in groundwater. We have just recently been able to receive some of the clean water funding to address some of the groundwater protection programs that we've been trying to maintain with limited funding over a number of years. Surface water protection has been a major issue, and it certainly will continue to be a major issue, in part because the standards are changing. And as standards and water quality analysis gets to lower levels, there'll be more and more questions that'll be asked, more and more efforts directed to address those places. And Mr. Chair, as I mentioned with Representative Hansen, bed bugs is an emerging issue, but I've already covered that.
We have a question here, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. To Mr. Buzicki, backtracking to the NPDES announcement that's coming today, could you describe a little bit more how state regulation and federal regulation kind of come together here, and possibly how what's happening in Minnesota compares to what's happening in other states across the country?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I will try, but it's confusing even for me. I'll make that statement. The pesticides are regulated under FIFRA and have been regulated basically with pesticide laws, a registration law. Thousands of products have to undergo very significant testing before they're used and available for sale. That testing over many years and millions of dollars results in a label. The label is the law. That's what we always say. The label is the law. So it contains all the cautions that are in regulatory terms that the user is responsible for. Then at the state level, we administer that, but here in Minnesota, we go beyond the federal law, and virtually every state does, and we have a Minnesota pesticide control law that deals with our particular issues that you, the legislature, have developed over the years. So that's how pesticide law has been addressed. Now, Here in Minnesota, we have a high priority on water quality protection, and groundwater protection law was passed. I've mentioned a number of times about how we've been cleaning up and promoting best management practices and so forth. So that's just a bit of evidence as to how our pesticide law has been adjusted for Minnesota-specific conditions. Several years ago, there was a lawsuit out in western United States in Washington, in which after a serious number of appeals and so forth, it was basically decided that pesticide law was not sufficient enough to protect water quality, the Clean Water Act, water quality in certain situations, and that legally the pesticide law was subservient to the Clean Water the Clean Water Act. And so if particular types of pesticides, there were some exemptions, and agriculture is one of those exemptions, but if particular types of pesticides were being used and found their way into water, then those uses, the court directed, needed to have a clean water clean water discharge permit, if you will. So that's the NPDES. So 2 years ago, EPA asked for a stay, and they received in a period of time of 2 years in which to get all 50 states and territories up to speed and issuing permits, these disposal permits. Generally, therefore, pesticides that are directly applied to aquatics, pesticides that are applied to forest canopies that may get into aquatics, pesticides that are used in rights of way, and I'm forgetting the fourth. And mosquitoes. And thank you, audience. And those pesticides that are applied to water for control of mosquitoes, there's an exemption for ag runoff. So in that very short period of time, the EPA, in conjunction with the clean water delegated agencies in each state, in our state that'd be the PCA, have had to work to develop a permitting program to implement this. And the reason that you need the permitting program is because if I apply as a, let's say, an aquatic applicator, if I apply and I don't have a permit, then I am subject to litigation, citizen litigation under the Clean Water Act, which is very significant. So I could be sued by any citizen. So what I want to do as an applicator is I want to be covered by that permit, so then my liability is taken care of. And I want to follow all the permit requirements. That's the gist of it. We can provide a fact sheet and so forth and provide more information to you. PCA is opening this up today for public comment. We have been working in support with our sister agency, and we've been working with a lot of grower groups and affected parties to the best of our ability, but we know that 2 years is a very, very short period of time to develop and promote a regulatory process. It's an impossible task. And I think we've been working very closely with EPA. Some states are ahead of us, some states are further behind of us, but the last conference call that I was on, there was an overwhelming feeling on the part of state agencies that we are not going to be fully ready. But most states are trying to get as ready as they can possibly be so that the applicators will be protected. They need to have this program in place April 9th. So it's a very, very fast track. And my guess is there will be a significant amount of litigation about this down the road as well.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bozicki, I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
Mr. Chair, perfect. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Say, can you tell me, I've been listening intently to, you do a lot of water regulation, water inspection, water analysis and things as such. Can you tell me, again, being new to the committee, if there's a private wells are, I think, under the Department of Health, I think, inspections and things as such, but if there was a pesticide fertilizer issue with a private well, how would you get involved? How would your agency get involved? What would you do, or would you do anything?
Okay. Mr. Brzezicki.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, first of all, in my tenure, I want to give a lot of credit to all the agencies in working with water issues. It goes across everybody's authorities. And this state, historically, for a number of years, has one of the best cooperative working relationships among the agencies of any state that I'm familiar with. As you may know, we're actually housed in the same building with the Department of Health right now, and that's very purposeful. Our authority deals with the regulation of pesticides and the protection of water quality from pesticides in this particular case, also fertilizer nutrients. So we do a bit of testing of private wells for survey purposes, but the actual regulation of that well is done by the Department of Health. If we were to encounter if we were to test a well and to find that there was a pesticide in that well, we would advise the well owner of what the standards are, the safe standards are, and that would have been provided to us by the Department of Health. We would provide them with information and resources to go to on how to address that. The issue is actually one of what the quantity is. I mean, some of our emerging technology, and this is what I was alluding to in my emerging issues, is we're able to get at levels so low that lower than we've ever been able to do before. Some other folks like USGS have been there. We have just recently gotten some equipment so that we can get down to some of these levels. So the question is always a matter of what the concentration is. If that concentration was very low, they would be advised of that. They would be provided with information and resources that would help explain that. If the concentration was even approaching any standard, they would be getting an advisory level from the Department of Health. If it was a very high level, because we've got a lot of experience cleaning things up, we might suspect a spill of some sort, and then we would actually go in and advise them and work on trying to figure out what that source of that spill might be. So very low, well, we see that frequently. You know, that's not an uncommon issue. Very, very low, minuscule. Close or above the standards, health is in action. Very high, in which we suspect a spill, we're in action.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions on staffing. I think we saw in the paper that the DNR had about 120 employees that took the early retirement option out, so they've phased out their employment with the state already or in the next few months. How many positions in your area are where people are taking that option?
Mr. Brzezicki?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we had 22 that were eligible within the division, and we had 2 that have taken that option.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and then in your portfolio of funds that fund your division, how much general fund is there as a percentage compared to the regulatory accounts, the fertilizer, and the pesticide?
Mr. Brzezicki.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the diagram shows that we are largely funded through fees, our dedicated account. Mr. Chair, and Representative Hansen, for the new members, just a couple of years ago, we came to the legislature with a fee increase and worked with industry folks. We had not received a fee increase in 19 years. So there's actually been a significant fee increase. We've been able to fill vacancies, and we've actually been doing some hiring to carry out some of those responsibilities. We also have a few staff that are tied to the Clean Water Funds for technical support. So we've actually been hiring in recent recent months.
Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, one final question. So if we had to do an across-the-board reduction in staffing, we would have to, you would have to be touching the dedicated dollars. You'd have to be touching and laying off or furloughing folks who were on pesticide dollars or fertilizer dollars or federal dollars or special dollars if you had to meet a percent across-the-board reduction in state fund, state employment.
Mr. Buzicki?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's correct. We have something over a $15 million annual budget, and out of that I think we get, I'm just splitting these numbers in half, about $650 in general fund. So it's the pesticide and fertilizer users, whether they're growers or people that go to their Target store, that largely support our programs. And we like to think that we received that fee increase relatively recently because we have a history of running science-based programs that provide firm but fair regulation, and it's a good information to make sure that when we do talk about policy matters, we're talking about science. So the answer to your question is yes. If we had to do it across the board, we would be reducing staff members that we have just been directed to increase our programs on, whether it's clean water or pesticides.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Mr. Brzezinski, you showed an earlier slide with the University of Minnesota framework, and that being one of the, I think, emerging issues, emerging problems. Could you tell us once more what that's about and also what that's funded through? How does that process receive funding?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, I think it was a week or perhaps 2 weeks ago that the framework was presented, I believe, to the Environment Committee, and this is a $750,000 two-year study conducted by the Dr. Deb Schwackhammer and the Water Resources Center over at the University of Minnesota to develop a 25-year plan for sustainability of water in Minnesota. It is broad-reaching, very broad-reaching, and it addresses agriculture and many, many other issues. I know the commissioner is reviewing that, and the agency has, so I guess I would prefer not to speak about a whole lot of detail, but suffice it to say that it does talk about some things like mandatory TMDLs and some practices that that the study participants and the authors, I shouldn't say the study participants, that the authors believe that Minnesota needs to put in place to protect water quality and water quantity for the next 25 years. So it's a very significant policy document that has brought a lot of attention, and I would imagine you'll be hearing about it. Well, I'm sorry. Ms. Cheney has pointed out that TMDLs is an acronym that perhaps you're not familiar with. TMDLs is total maximum daily loads. It goes back to that program I was talking about earlier, or the authority I was talking about earlier, the Federal Clean Water Act. Very simply, it's easier to think about the Clean Water Act from a point, from a pipe, which we're familiar with, and what would happen is some industry would be discharging into a river, and they would be told they have to discharge at certain total maximum daily loads, certain allocation. Now, that concept has been applied to non-point sources, agriculture among them, and so now we're trying to wrestle with, because everybody doesn't, every grower doesn't have a particular pipe, how to deal with things on a watershed basis. So the idea of the framework is to figure out how to protect, from Minnesota's point of view, how to protect water resources, and from the federal point of view, there's already a program in place. The university is suggesting that rather than voluntary targets for growers to meet and watersheds to meet, that they become mandatory. But, Mr. Chair, I'm not doing it justice. It's a very complex, broad-reaching document, and I'm not the person to be explaining this to the committee, to be fair, and perhaps Dr. Schwackhammer would be the person that would best be able to describe this whole program. However, the report is, I think the report is a couple hundred pages, and it is on their website, so I'd be happy to provide that to you.
And a follow-up for Representative Morrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this for Ms. Cheney and maybe this for another day, but we saw that the Senate introduced a bill today that calls for $4 million in cuts to the University of Minnesota's Agriculture and Extension Services. So I was trying to find out whether the framework comes under that or not. If you could help us, Ms. Cheney, and other relevant folks in the room to understand what gets cut as we move forward here. So I don't know whether the framework is in that $4 million or not. I'm guessing it's not. But I think it would help the whole committee as we move forward and need to make another $5 billion of cuts after this bill, that we understand what those cuts are affecting.
Ms. Cheney?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrill, I believe that the framework was actually funded by the Heritage Council funds, the sales tax revenue, but absolutely I'd be happy to follow along with the bills that get introduced and let you know how those will impact agriculture in Minnesota.
We have one more topic, but first a question from Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bozicki, as long as we were talking about the budget here a little while ago on the graph that you had, two of the smaller items on there are the remediation fund and the federal funds. Just explain for me, the remediation fund, is that penalties paid by licensees, or where does that money come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Szymanski, the remediation fund is actually is not paid by penalties. The penalties, if they're a pesticide penalty, they go back into the pesticide budget. If it's a fertilizer, it goes back into the fertilizer budget. The remediation fund is actually, if I'm not mistaken, is the dollars that were set aside. Let me go back. We have a surplus. The fees that users have paid into the cleanup fund, the ACRA account, were not fully being utilized because we didn't have enough staff to provide the oversight for the cleanup. The way I explain it is it's as if we didn't have enough insurance adjusters and we had a backlog of accidents to go out and evaluate. What we did is we asked the legislature if we could access the remediation, the cleanup fund, for to hire more insurance adjusters to actually provide the oversight. The federal funds question, that is our FIFRA dollars. EPA provides about $400,000 to $500,000 each year to our division to help them administer the FIFRA, the federal pesticide law. So those are federal dollars.
All right, thank you. Okay. And lastly, talking about the laboratory services, Ms. Cheney.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd like to just add one last thing about the budget at the pesticide and fertilizer division. Again, highlighting the clean water funds, which again are at zero for the start of the biennium. The laboratory services division really assists the other regulatory divisions with their work, whether it's evaluating samples from Greg's division on pesticide and fertilizer samples in water, whether it's investigating or analyzing samples that were taken by Dr. Kassenberg's division with dairy samples or meat samples that were taken during the course of their inspections, or whether it's analyzing products that have come about that Plant Protection Division has identified. Their mission is to provide efficient, prompt, objective, and accurate analysis, information, and technical leadership in cooperation with the department programs, applicable laws, and regulations which protect the state of Minnesota's agriculture, environment, and food chain. And their budget is $8 million in general funds, $5.44 million in ag funds, and another nearly $5 million in federal funds. They have approximately 52 FTEs and a total budget of $18.7 million. I guess the other thing I'd like to add is that they're basically paid for, in addition to their general fund dollars, they're paid for by the divisions. So their services are, each division gives the laboratory funds based on the use of their divisions. And they also provide some laboratory analysis for the DNR. That's it.
Is that it? Representative Anderson.
Well, I'm thankful for the overview. I just have one question, and maybe it goes to Dr. Katzenberg. I'm just wondering if the dairy division inspects when there are a complaint made by dairy farmers regarding stray voltage on their dairy cattle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm getting the sign from Dr. Katzenberg that no, that's not the case. That division inspects largely for food value of the livestock and sanitation, and any reports of stray voltage would be received by our dairy development teams, which I think I've mentioned in the past, they work with livestock owners on the health of the animals.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to give a quick update. Today we were invited, the exec board was invited over to meet with the governor, the governor's residence, and we're talking about agriculture and the importance of. And the governor pointed out as well that historically this has been a very bipartisan or even a nonpartisan committee, and he looks forward to working with us on rural issues and also working with the commissioner as well about rural development. And I think Representative Ward, step out, but Representative Ward and I have been talking about some of these rural development ideas, and so I just wanted to bring it up to everybody, bring those forward. We have commitment from both the new commissioner, the ag commissioner, and also the governor today to, again, work in a very bipartisan way to address rural economies and Department of Agriculture issues as well. So. The other thing, Ms. Cheney, talking with the Commissioner of Agriculture, you talked about a China delegation that's visiting. Would you be able to give us an update on that as well, at all?
Ms. Yes, Cheney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, you all should have invitations that look like this. They were delivered to your LAs or stuck under your door on Friday as soon as they were given to me. We have a China trade delegation that's coming, an export mission from China that's coming to sign an agreement for a purchase of soybeans. And the Department of Agriculture is hosting a lunch on January 19th from 12 to 1, and you're all invited to attend that. It's at the Freeman Building, which is the Department of Ag building on the ground floor level. And if you need any further information or want more copies of the invitation, if you didn't see it, I'd be happy to help you with that.
Thank you. Without any further questions, I see we have another new member today. thank you all for your attention. Representative Hamilton, what's the schedule like for the rest of the week?
As far as the next meeting will be tomorrow on Wednesday, there will be no meeting on Thursday. I will be so the pork producers are in town this week, so we're on a panel over there. But we're going to have Mr. Reinholz. He's going to be updating the committee tomorrow. And, so one meeting tomorrow.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions? If not, today's meeting is adjourned.